Well, welcome to all of you. Back at the beginning of the century, an Indian saint made a very interesting prophecy. He was visiting America. His name was Swami Ramatirtha. And he said that someday you Americans will take this science of yoga and make it practical and bring it back to my people. And when I was in India lecturing about 20 years ago, and there were crowds of 2,000 at a time coming to the talks, they reminded me of this and said that they felt that this prophecy was being fulfilled. Today I was going to talk to you on the subject of yoga in the West, the role of yoga in the West. And I feel that we have to understand that we have something to add to this science of yoga. Not in the sense of improving it, but rather in the sense of making it understandable to the people of this day and age. There are two ways of approaching the subject of yoga and of Indian teachings here in the West, and one is to teach it from a standpoint of using all foreign words, all foreign concepts, including in it the entire sort of mystique of incense and robes and long hair and everything that goes with the Indian mood. And the other way has tended too much in the other direction, I think, and that is to teach it from a standpoint of, well, we want to make it totally American. We want to leave out all Indian words. We want to use it in the context of what we are accustomed to seeking in the West. So we find that yoga is often taught primarily from a standpoint of just physical benefits, slimming your hips or whatever it might be, in a purely physical sense. And there are a lot of teachers that I've talked to in different parts of the West who tell me they don't dare teach more for fear that they would lose students. I think somewhere between these two is the real role of yoga in the West. That there are certain words which we might as well just keep because we don't have any comparable words. You talk of the Ira and the Pingala and the Kundalini and so on, what are you going to say? There isn't anything in our language that remotely corresponds to them. You can talk of the sympathetic nervous system, but that doesn't even really do it. Apart from the fact that it doesn't inspire any kind of spiritual interest, it refers strictly to the body, where when we speak of the Ira and the Pingala, there are physical counterparts of these currents, but we're really talking of currents in the astral body. And what do you do with that in English? Even words that we know are words that we use differently. For example, the very word meditation, we don't actually have a word to correspond with the concept of meditation in India. What we have are words that are approximate. When you meditate on something, really you think about it. You dwell on various aspects of it. You think around it. But when you meditate, according to the Indian concept, you don't think at all. There are different kinds of meditation that are used for helping a person to grow spiritually. Meditations not just on a problem, but, for example, in the Catholic Church, they use meditations to, like the meditations of St. Ignatius of Loyola, which are their techniques, their visualizations. And through those visualizations, you transcend, hopefully transcend thought, ultimately go into a higher state of consciousness. So meditation can be used either in the mundane sense of just thinking about your problems or in the spiritual sense of thinking or visualizing things that lift you upward. But nonetheless, meditation in our Western terminology means exactly the opposite in this sense from opposite of what the yogic concept of dhyana is really all about. We have to transcend thought if we are going to attain that state. Well, we don't have a word, but we have something approximate enough for all yogis, there isn't an exception that I know of, to have used the word meditate, but in a new way. In a sense, what we're really doing is redefining some of our terms rather than bringing in new terms. And I think that's valid. I think that's the process of a language's development anyway. But the more that we can use our own words, the more that we can use our own concepts. Interestingly enough, Yogananda, when he started out in this country, wore his hair long in the streets and wore a robe, and he was walking down the streets of Boston one day, and a group of factory girls on their lunch break were following him, giggling. Finally, one of them got the nerve up to pull his hair, and he turned around and had a little chat with them about how you should not laugh at somebody just because his customs are different. And for a time he tried to educate the Americans in the Indian way, but he saw that wasn't working, and he had to be selective if he was really going to get across what he wanted to. In fact, the message that they were getting was that if you want to practice what he was teaching, then you've got to wear a robe and get your hair long and preferably go and live in a cave in India. And all those exotic things, to us they're exotic, to them they aren't. I remember living in India, seeing an article in a Madras newspaper mentioning those exotic American ideas. And to them we're exotic. But at any rate, they are exotic to us, the things that are a part of their sort of cultural accoutrements. And so what Yogananda did, and I feel that it was a very valid direction for the teaching of yoga in general here in the West, was not to try to Indianize, but to try to spiritualize the West and America particularly. And he took to wearing a suit, even in his own hermitage. He would wear a robe when he gave services, but otherwise he dressed in normal Western garb. He wanted to give people the message that what I'm teaching you, you can practice. Well, what I've observed in a lifetime just about by now of traveling around the world and teaching these things has been a corroboration of what he and others have said, that the West basically has an external orientation. The East has an internal orientation. It's very interesting even to listen to the music. If you listen to Indian music, you hear the tambura on this chant that I sang, God, God, God. It's not as appropriate for that song as it would be if I were singing an Indian raga. But the mood of the Indian sitar, veena, various instruments that they play, it's always, first of all, it's always a melody. They don't have chords. Secondly, there's a quality to those melodies that's very much a sort of aspiration of the individual soul for communion with the infinite. And here in the West, you can hear it even in the fact of the chords being so much a part of our tradition. Polyphony is, according to musicologists, almost uniquely a Western invention. I find it impossible to believe, but that's what they tell us anyway. I can't imagine the potential for chords having been ignored by everybody for so long. But anyway, our chords are very much an expression of our wish to get people to work together, to cooperate, our seeing of relationships between groups of people. And even when you listen to the religious music of the West, the beautiful Mass of Mozart, the fantastic music of Bach, it always has something of the mental image, not of the individual soul alone with God in the infinite, but rather of a host of angels all praising God on the throne or at the top of a mountain or something, where there's this big group kind of symphonic effort together. And it's very devotional, it's very beautiful, but it's very different. The whole entrance of the Jewish religion in the form of Christ into the West, and it really was Jesus was, after all, a Jew. There was this story of a Catholic and a Jew discussing how high you could rise in your own religion. And the Jew said, well, how high can you people rise? And he said, well, priest, and so on. He went all the way up to the Pope, and he said, you can't go any higher. And he said, what do you expect, Jesus Christ? And the Jew said, why not? One of our boys made it. The introduction of Christianity into the West, of Judaism into the West, in the form of Christianity. And in fact, I have a book called The First Christian, and that, you know who that was? St. Paul. The introduction of it brought it automatically into a way of life that was the Greco-Roman emphasis. It was external, it was laws, it was, well, the Judaic system had a lot of laws too, but it was still touched very much by the Orient. And basically they were Orientals in mood. Whereas when you got into the Greco-Roman world, you got into a totally rationalistic world. And everything had to be done by external laws for the good of everybody. And the trend has been in that direction here in the West. In the early centuries in Western Christianity, there was a lot of meditation, according to our concept of meditation, people going out by their in their thousands to the desert to commune with God and give their lives to communion. There's one interesting passage in a book of mine called The Desert Fathers where somebody visits this hermit who's been out there for who knows how many decades, and the hermit says, oh, you're from the world, are you? What empire is reigning supreme now? He was so out of touch he didn't even know. Then gradually this whole system began to become more and more firmed. For example, with the rule of Saint Benedict. Until then, no doubt basing their whole approach on the Eastern, the monks had tended to just wander from monastery to monastery the way the sannyasis of India do today. And he, in his rule, made a deliberate effort to control them and bring them under the sway of a particular monastery and a particular rule. And some of his rules are even rather funny. There is one rule for how they will serve the meal. And while they're eating, the bread is to be brought in by a pulley arrangement, coming in above, down to the table from the kitchen, to give the monks the inspired feeling that their food comes from heaven, that God is the real provider. But this gimmick that you put into the rule seems a bit much. And then the rule gradually began to become firmed to, well, let me express to you the difference. It's really encapsulated perfectly in this one contrast. About 1000 AD, a question was asked of a monk. If a person in the monastery is meditating, praying, I should say, and during his prayer he becomes lifted up into a state of ecstasy, and then the bell rings for the divine office that they all said together, what should he do? Should he stay in his prayer and communion, or should he leave it and go join the monks following the rules of the community? The answer was he should stay in his prayer, because the purpose of the rule is to bring you to that point where you commune with God. So it would be leaving the higher for the lower. Now that, according to the Indian tradition, would be self-evident. Nobody would question that. What makes this a very interesting point in the evolution of religion in the West is that that very same question was asked about the turn of this century here in the West. And the answer was exactly the opposite. They said that you should leave your higher state because the highest thing is obedience. Obedience to the rule, obedience to your superior, obedience to the system. And your whole religion should become, you should recognize that your relationship with God is a secondary thing to be taken care of perhaps after you die. But while you're here, your duty while you're here is to be obedient to the system, the church, and all the external trappings of the church. In that same line, the theologians of this century, all across the board virtually, I don't know of a well-known exception, and if you do, I'd like you to tell me. They are all saying that religion should be brought out into the streets, which of course it should be. But what they're really saying is that religion should be, if I can coin a word, streetified. Bad. But I remember just a month ago I was in London, and I had to listen to an English minister talking with almost, it was a diatribe, just very angrily saying that to these people that they've got to politicize their religion. And this has been the trend of religion this century. One theologian said that you should love God, not man. I mean man, not God, excuse me. Man, not God. God can take care of himself. Man's the one who needs your love. Well, of course, the Indian tradition would say that if you don't love God first, then how can you really love man? And the Bible tells us again and again that we should love God first. All the scriptures have said this. To bring religion out into the streets should be not to politicize religion and make religion just a matter of giving to the United Crusade. It should be a matter of making people, even in the streets, God-conscious. That even in the shops, they think about higher realities when they're serving people. So they don't think only in terms of gain, but of service. They work joyfully and not under the constant and growing tension that we see. And Jean-Paul Sartre, who God knows was not a theologian, nevertheless managed to echo some of these thoughts when he said that in this world that bleeds, all joy is obscene. And again, the question would be, if a person's drowning, do you jump into the water and drown with him? Is that the way to show compassion? Isn't it better to stand on the land and throw a line to him and pull him out? We see that great masters don't. They may weep for other people's foolishness and ignorance, but they don't enter into that foolishness and ignorance. Their compassion is a compassion like an adult maybe feeling very sympathetic for a child who's broken his toy. But at the same time, he recognizes that this is a very small thing in the overall spectrum of life. And so he doesn't enter into the same sense of tragedy as the child. He's sympathetic, and on that level he enters into it. But he's sympathetic from a vision of greater wisdom and greater calmness, and he's not really affected by it personally. If he is, he's really hardly fit to be a parent. He's childish. The way to help people is not to enter into their grief, but to give them joy. In this world that bleeds, all joy is the most desperately needed thing in the world, is the answer to Sartre. But our theologians and our philosophers and all have been really, if you look at the changes in the church today, back to the ecumenical councils in the Catholic Church, back to all the things that are happening in the churches, the United Protestant things, whatever it's called, I forget now. Anybody know? Anyway, they have become exceedingly, the Protestants have become exceedingly political, and that seems to be their focus, as far as I can tell. And the Catholics have become very much trying to become relevant in the sense of trying to reach people in an outward way. The monks and nuns are leaving their monasteries in droves, but to go back to a worldly life, not to live religion in a more vital way. The ideal of the mystical communion with the higher self is slipping away very fast from people's grasp here in the West and, in fact, in the East. If you go to India today, you think, well, everybody in India knows yoga. You'd be amazed how few people even know what yoga means. It's just incredible how little they know of this great tradition that's been brought. Well, wherever you have a growth of energy and emphasis in one direction, you've usually got it also at least building up steam, perhaps less observably, but you've always got the opposite. This world is made of opposites. And what's happening here now is that there is this growing trend. It's still sort of undercover, but I even read in Newsweek a couple of years ago, I think it was, that there were some 8 million people in America practicing meditation or some form of yoga and some related things. That's a lot of people in this country, considering where we are right now. There is a growing move toward wanting to find something that is more internal, rather than just, we see that we can't find what we're looking for if we're just going to get things, and we find that the longer we try to bring things together, the more they're all like that croquet match in Alice in Wonderland. You've all read Alice in Wonderland, haven't you? You remember how when Alice would start to swat the ball, the mallet turned out to be a flamingo that would raise its head up at her and look at her, and then the ball would turn out to be a hedgehog that would uncurl and start walking away. And this was a marvelous sort of a parody of the way the world is. Lewis Carroll was, in fact, a famous mathematician, and he was well aware of how totally illogical life is as compared to the mathematician's logical expectations. And so we're finding that the world is like that now. It's sort of slipping away from us. Every time we try to bring it together, it slips away in some new direction. So there is a great need for something practical. And that's what the science of yoga is all about. But the interesting thing is that what we've learned here in the West is by no means without its own validity. The ability to bring things together in an outward way is essential for us to be able to see more clearly those subtle currents of consciousness within ourselves that we'd never see if we didn't have an opportunity to test them in the battlefield of life. You don't know, I've seen many people, in fact this has been an interesting observation that I and others have made of many teachers from India. I don't speak of masters because they're above it, but the many swamis and others who have come from India, many others who live in India, are incredibly childish in human emotions. They simply aren't capable of observing when they're being just outrageously jealous or petty or upset about little things. You think, how is it possible? But the reason is that their emphasis has been so much on being alone or just meditating on your own. They haven't emphasized the need for outward proving of what your inner gains are, that they haven't developed the tools necessary to be able to discriminate and see themselves clearly. If you never meet people, it's very possible to think you're peaceful just because nothing's come along to keep you from having peace. Then some little thing comes along and you fly off the handle. Well, as one great saint put it, your religion is tested in the cold light of day. We need that cold light of day. We need the association of other people. I was talking to a saint, and this has been the tendency of great saints in India, and I honor that tendency. I don't mean to put it down, but I think that we need to see it from both sides. He was talking about the importance of doing, in fact, what he had done. He had gone off and spent his whole life meditating. And he was a very great saint. One man told me, he was a villager in the little village in Annaredipalayam down in Andhra Pradesh, told me that he had known him many years ago when he had decided to just spend his time meditating. And he had... The saint had built himself a little kutir, a little cottage, in the cremation grounds. And it was a fairly safe place to go because nobody bothered him. And the yogis often like to meditate in such environments because they feel it's a constant reminder of the impermanence of life. And this man wanted to see what was going on in there, you know, and so he found a little chink in this cottage wall, and he looked through the chink. And he saw the room inside was just full, blazing with light. And he just couldn't believe his eyes. And then gradually as he looked, the light diminished. And this saint came out and he said that, he said, you'd better not look into that light. It could hurt your eyes. But he knew what he was thinking. Well, anyway, this saint told me that as far as he was concerned, everybody should just spend their whole time meditating. And I brought in the obvious counter thought, supposing they can't. I had met a lot of yogis in the Himalayas who spent their time sleeping, not meditating. And when they weren't sleeping, they were eating. And when they weren't eating, they were gossiping. And the amount of time that they had to meditate wasn't very much. And Yogananda said that what happens with many of those people is that they become physically lazy, first of all, because their food is provided for them, they don't have to do anything. And then gradually they become mentally lazy. Finally, they become spiritually lazy, and they just become bums. And so if a person can indeed meditate 12, 15, 18 hours a day, great. But if he can't, what's he going to do with the time that he's not meditating? He ought to spend it in a practical way. Well, this saint wasn't taking into account, in short, the 99.9% of the human race, not the human race, leave them aside, 99.9% of the human devotees who are already on the path. He wasn't taking them into account. And so I mentioned them to him, and he said, well, they should work hard. But they often don't address themselves to everybody. They address themselves to those few people that they are trying to reach to make racehorses out of. And I think that it's a very important thing to reach the others too. Moreover, I have seen, as I've said, this tendency to, in ignoring the outer world, to become impractical. And you can't find God if you aren't practical. In fact, Saint Teresa of Avila gave as her rule for whom to accept in her monastery. The qualification for acceptance was that they have common sense. She said, devotion they can develop, but common sense, if they don't have it, they'll never develop. And it was an interesting thing because her path was so mystical, the most mystical of them all, at least at that time. So, anyway, what the West can give to the East is this understanding of how to work together, this understanding of how to test what we've gained in the outer world and how to bring that back into the inner. And in the divine plan, and this has been said by more than one master, in the divine plan, it was intended during a time when mankind could not get anywhere if he didn't specialize, it was intended that the Western world would develop external skills and that the Eastern world, and India particularly, would develop internal skills, meditative skills, and that then the time would come, and this prediction was made both by one of the early popes and by many of the masters and teachers in the East, that the time would come, and the time has come, to bring these two together. Each can help the other. That's what Swami Ramatirtha was saying when he spoke about the Americans taking this science and making it practical. Making it practical doesn't mean making it necessarily real, because it was plenty real before. It was practical in an inner sense. But making it practical in an outward sense so that it can influence one's entire life and not just be for people who want to go off and seal themselves in a cave. To make it practical in the worldly sense, this is something that we are particularly qualified to do. And I think it would help us to understand that, because if we're going to be teaching yoga in the West, then these two opposite directions that I've seen yoga teachings going in, I think both need to be brought back to a central point of balance between them. The first one, the creation of this great sort of mystical aura, we all feel that. We feel in tune with that. Probably, when I say all of us, I don't know whether that's too bold a statement, but it's a very normal thing for the people who are in the forefront of a movement to be those people who in past incarnations were enmeshed in it, or engrossed in it, I should say, since enmeshed means you can't get out, engrossed in it. And the people in America today who were very interested in yoga are probably almost all, if not all, people who were yogis before or people who were in India before and felt a deep attraction to this. And naturally they would carry over with them an attraction to the whole Indian thing. We all feel it here in this community. I've always felt it. I'm in tune with India in a way that I've never been in tune with America. The whole thing. I love Indian food. I love Indian music. I love Indian incense and clothing and gestures and everything else. I've often been called an Indian in an American body, and I really am. I remember a class that I gave in Sacramento about 12 years ago, I guess it was, or 14 years ago. This older woman came to take my yoga posture classes first. And then she came to take my meditation classes. And she said, you know, when I first came, I just wanted a conversation piece to make interesting conversation at my bridge parties. But, you know, as I got into it, I found, my, this is really serious, so I want to learn more. But the reason she wanted to learn more was that I tried to put it to her in such a way as to reach her where she was, but to show her how she could be led from that to wanting more and more that would give her more and more of what she wants. People don't only want to slim their hips. They obviously want more than that. They want happiness, they want peace of mind, they want wisdom. These are native hungers. And yoga is a science par excellence for helping to fulfill those hungers. So in those ways, yoga can be made practical. There are other things too. India is a very old, old civilization. It's probably the oldest civilization in the world. And like a tree that just has been growing and growing and growing, sometimes it needs pruning. There's a story they tell in India also of a man who died and his son wanted to perform the Shraddha ceremony for him. And during the ceremony, they were in their little prayer room, during the ceremony, a dog from the neighborhood strayed into the prayer room. And a dog was considered an unclean animal to have at a religious ceremony, so the man hastily jumped up and took the dog outside and tied it to a post on the veranda and came back and sat down and concluded his ceremony. Well, many, many years later he died and his son wanted to perform the Shraddha ceremony correctly, and he remembered this dog that was tied to a post on the veranda. Well, he didn't have a dog, but he went out and borrowed one and brought it and tied it to the post. And gradually, over the generations, the dog became the most important part of this family's funeral ceremony. Well, in this way, the story is told in India to show how traditions may not always come from some high inspiration, but become sanctified by usage, and how necessary it is from time to time to prune that tree and get people back to the basics. Some yogi told me that there are in the path of Laya Yoga something like, I don't know the exact figure, but like 133,000 techniques. We couldn't possibly learn all the techniques. That's just Laya Yoga, which I think probably has a minimum of techniques compared with Raja Yoga and Hatha Yoga and perhaps not with Bhakti Yoga, but even in Bhakti Yoga there are techniques. So we need to bring it down to what it's really basically all about, because otherwise there are a lot of people who can spend so much time walking the path that they never even think about the goal. Spend so much time doing their different exercises and techniques that they forget why they're doing it. And spend so much time developing some little sort of sideline of, let's say, power, that they never get down to the essence of what it was all about. There was this story of a great saint in India called Baba Goroknath. He's still very well known. He lived 300 years, and during those 300 years, he developed all the eight siddhis of Patanjali, of yoga, and he was a great yogi, But he wasn't liberated. He still had attachment to those powers. And when he saw that the time had come for him to leave his body, he wanted to pass these powers on to some worthy recipient. And he looked through the spiritual eye, and he saw this young yogi sitting on the banks of the Ganges in deep samadhi, and he thought, he's worthy. So he appeared before him, and he had 8 pellets of mud into which he had condensed these powers. And he said, I'm Baba Goroknath. And he expected the man to sort of gasp in awe. And the yogi sort of looked at him as if, why have you come to disturb my meditation, was his basic attitude. And so Goroknath said, I see that the time has come for me to leave my body, and I feel that you are worthy to receive these powers. If you will just take these pellets and hold them in your hand, you'll be able to absorb these powers within yourself. And the man took the young man took the pellets, and he said, are these mine to do with as I choose? And Goroknath said, yes, of course. I'm giving them to you. He took them and threw them into the Ganges, where they dissolved. And Goroknath said, what have you done? It took me 300 years to develop these powers. And the young man looked at him calmly, and he said, in delusion yet, Baba Goroknath. And suddenly Goroknath realized that after all, powers, what are they? They're just of this world. They're of the ego. Yogananda was one time, he mentioned that my detractors have said that I've lost my powers. He said, I don't know that I ever had any powers. This is the way of a master. There's no ego principle involved. What they do is express whatever is to be expressed there, but there's never the thought, I want it. It's as if the divine wants it through me. Whenever Ramakrishna or one of the other great masters performed a miracle, there was never the thought, I perform this miracle. It was just that this is the way the divine chose to manifest through him. And so, the practice of yoga very often has drawn people off into one direction or another to develop that which is permanent, the ego, the body. These things are all right as a stepping stone to something higher. They're not all right if they become the focus of our attention. And in an age such as we're in, where mankind still does not live long compared to the golden age when he's supposed to live some centuries, this is the tradition anyway. At any rate, in this day and age, I remember when I started out in life, I deliberately set myself certain goals that I knew I couldn't possibly fulfill until my mid-50s. That, of course, was predicated on the expectation that I'd live to my mid-50s. Lots of people don't. There might have been other goals that would not have been possible to achieve before the age of 100. But the chances of living to be 100 are so slim as to make that kind of expectation unrealistic. So we have to set ourselves goals that are somewhat realistic. And if we try to do too much, then we won't reach the really important goal. What I'm really basically saying is that we should, recognizing the shortness of life, recognizing particularly that we haven't that much time that we can devote to it. We're not living in the kind of age when people can just give their whole time to spiritual practices. There are grocery bills to pay, we've got to drive on the freeway, we've got to compete with a society that is not at all in tune with spiritual ideals. We've got to do so many things just to keep body and soul together, that the amount of time that we have to spend on spiritual practices is considerably curtailed. So that too makes it important that we pare the tree. But it's also simply that in every person's life, even a master, he'll always want to add something. It's just the nature of things. You don't want to just quote what everybody else has said. You'll always speak from your own experience. You'll always speak from your own discoveries. And it very usually happens, at least in the case of great masters, that they have been sent with a particular thing to contribute at a particular time. It's sort of like if the goal is to go to the equator, people who are north of the equator are told to go south. People who are south of the equator are told to go north. And incidentally, that's where you find the big quarrel in religion, that you get the people in these different groups saying, we, in our path, go south. No, no, our teacher said you must go north. And so you have this big quarrel when all they both wanted was to see you at the equator. And then what it is that the teacher, if you have strayed too far north, will have to add that teaching of go south. Whereas before they may have been closer to the equator and it wasn't that much of an issue, and they talked of something else. And so with all the corrections that come in with the different lives of masters, with all the additions that they make, gradually you get a tradition, a body of tradition, that becomes top-heavy. And there come times, periodically, in history, when you've got to pare it back to the essence, what it's really all about, and start from there and go outward from that again. Otherwise you have more than any one person can handle. On our own path, how many techniques do we have? Gosh, if you read the lessons of Yogananda, there are maybe 100 techniques. And then think of the different paths here that are available in this country and all the techniques that are taught. How can anybody follow them all? Yogananda himself said that if you follow 1/100th of what I teach, you'll get there. We have to, of course, the problem is finding the right 1/100th, I think. But we need to bring it back to what we're really doing. And here, the logical approach of the West is very helpful. There's no substitute for true inspiration. But what I've found in my years in India, I couldn't understand it at first. Because I have such a logical mind, and it's so trained in the Western ways of excluding anything except the one thing you're trying to get to. I could not understand how intelligent Indians could engage in a conversation with me, disagree with me, and yet not call me wrong. I mean, one of us had to be right and the other one had to be wrong according to our Western way of thinking. But they didn't look at it that way. They felt that there are many ways of being right. To me, this just, I couldn't understand it until I realized gradually that their way was much more sophisticated than ours. Because life, in fact, is much too complex to be able to say that there's only one right and then the other is wrong. The black and white methods of Western logic are priceless in certain fields of endeavor, but they become a stumbling block in others. Well, what India has done has been, again and again, I have read books. Now, in the whole world, I've never met so many really great people as I have in India. It's just been amazing to me, going into a publishing house, going into a shop, and meeting somebody who has such wonderful wisdom and such a large heart and such a broad vision. It's been amazing and inspiring. But what I have seen is that those people in India who don't come up to that standard, don't come up to our standards by any means. Again and again I have read in books, well, this will exemplify it perfectly. Gary Snyder told me he met some pundit in Benares who said, you know, in all of the excavations and all the archaeological excavations that they have made, they haven't found a single wire. That proves that they had the wireless. What I have seen in India is that again and again they use the word this proves, when to our logical minds it doesn't prove it at all. There are all sorts of other objections that you could bring in. It doesn't prove anything. They don't know how to reason as logically as we do because their cultural training is intuitive. I don't mean that there aren't Indians who are not exceedingly logical, but it's not the norm. They have a very intuitive grasp. There was this great Indian mathematician. He was virtually illiterate, but he was found to be so amazingly accurate and advanced in his immediate grasp of mathematics that he came to the attention of some Englishmen who finally took him to London. He was just far in advance of the most advanced Western mathematicians. The most advanced English mathematician became his best friend, and he told the story that on this Indian's deathbed, I believe his name was Raman, but I'm not certain. On his deathbed, the Englishman came to the hospital to see him, and the Indian asked him what the license plate, what number his license plate was on the taxi. And the Englishman, knowing his fascination for numbers, had made it a point to remember it. So he told him, and the Indian said, "Oh, what a wonderful number. It's the lowest number that comes from the cube of one and the square of another." The addition. He just had it like that. It took the Englishman 6 months to figure out the number that he meant. The combination, the cube of which and the square of which. But that's more. I saw an Indian woman on TV who was able to write out the answers to mathematical problems on a blackboard. And she was able to write them out just as fast as the man was telling them. She got in, they had her in competition with a computer in Australia, and she beat the computer every time, except once. The computer beat her, and she said, but the computer, no, the computer didn't beat her, but the computer got a different answer. She said, well, the computer's wrong. Which is laughable, but it proved that it was so. Somebody had touched a wrong something or other. Anyway, the computer was the one that made the mistake. So you see here a quality of thinking that isn't rational in our way. The reasoning of the mind. St. Teresa of Avila said that in ecstasy, the soul comprehends truths that it would take it on a rational level, reading and studying and thinking, would take it many years to comprehend. The soul comprehends in just a flash. The intuitive power of the mind is far, far higher than the reasoning power. But the reasoning power is what we've got to work with on this everyday level. And when Indians have to work on this everyday level, the mundane level, then they don't have what we have. We have a much greater grasp of this particular faculty. We're trained in it. We understand it. It's a limited faculty, but within its own framework, it works very well for us. And the two really need to be brought together in this sense, that unless a master comes and just cuts right through it and says, these are the only things that matter, and they'll say it in some ways, but you can't get them to say it on everything, unless they do, the Western approach of being able to weed out, what are we really trying to do? What's it really about? This is a very, very timely adjunct to the whole study of yoga. Yogananda recommended that there be laboratories in which people study the effectiveness of different techniques, that they study how well different methods, not only techniques but ways of living and so on, actually work, and prove it. This is an age when Indians themselves can understand that kind of thinking, because now, for quite a long time, they've been trained in Western scholarship. The schools and colleges in India are teaching them according to the Western system. And so they, when I went and taught them and lectured to all those thousands of people, what I was doing that drew so many thousands was showing them that their ancient science is totally compatible with the findings of modern science, with modern reason, with modern civilization, with the demands of modern times. And they were fascinated because they had been thinking that yoga was something totally removed from that whole scene and something of an ancient tradition that didn't have any relevance today. What we're having now is that both in India and in the West, we're coming to the point where the combination of these two is very helpful. Another thing that I feel in the teaching of yoga in the West is that we need to draw the teaching to a focus. In India, if you want to be a wandering sadhu, you've at least got places to wander to. Here, where have you got to go? There, we may have pilgrimage spots, but they aren't very well known as such. The American Indians had certain holy mountains, and there are a few places that may have been blessed by saints that have certain power, but very few people know of the existence of even one. And because people haven't kept up these traditions, even a place like Mount Shasta, I don't think it has, although it has an ancient tradition of being a place of power, I don't feel the power there that I would expect. I think that it just hasn't, you've got to keep these things going. It's like a spring. If you don't use it, the water will tend to find another way to flow. And so I think that we need to start drawing it to a focus. I think that's one of the things that is the trend of yoga in the West today. Communities like Ananda, different spiritual centers, places where people live or places where people gather, I think that's very important. Another thing that's important is the understanding, and this is something that they do understand in the East, to the point where they don't even need to talk about it. It's just accepted. And so they haven't talked about it, and we haven't got the message. But we think, and we're quite wrong in this, we think that teaching is what you convey through words. Well, of course it is to some extent, but that's only an overflow. The real teaching is vibration. The real teaching, you think of how many people go to art school. They learn all the same things. If out of one graduating class there's one person who can even make it as an artist and really be I'm sure some of them can be commercial artists, but I mean a real artist, that's already saying a lot. That must be a pretty good school to be able to produce one really fine artist. History hasn't given us that many fine artists. All of them have learnt the same things, but how many are able to grasp it? Because teaching is not just a question of knowing the technique. And yoga, in fact, needs to be understood in that way too. The yoga isn't just technique. Yoga is an intuitive kind of grasp of the thing. It's a flow. And you can convey, in the sense you can teach, and this is the way they really teach. I'm sure all of you have read Autobiography of a Yogi. And in fact, a lot of Western hippies in the 60s, reading the Autobiography of a Yogi, thought, well, gosh, if I go to India, maybe some yogi will slap me on the chest and I'll go into samadhi and no more hard work. And so they went there in their thousands and it didn't happen. You have to prepare yourself. And yet, that teaching still is true, that when you're ready, a touch, a conveyance of magnetism, this is what it's really about. If you can change a person's consciousness, that can be done in ways that can't be seen and can't be explained. But it happens all the time. You meet some people in whose presence you grow, and you meet other people in whose presence you somehow feel pulled down. You meet some people, it's an inspiration to be around. And there are other people who, as soon as you're with them, you suddenly feel as if you don't want to think about higher things, and you tend to feel more moody, or whatever it might be. It's very important to understand that the teaching is not philosophy and technique alone. Those are important. But the way that a person goes, there are many different rays of divine grace, divine power that come into this world. And those people who want to be really, really great in their own field, who want to really advance in their own field, need to tune in to one or another of those rays. I don't think that Beethoven could have existed as he was if it hadn't been for all those other musicians that were composing at the same time. There was a tradition built up. Goethe, who's been described as having the greatest mind that ever was, he said that he attributed about 97% of his genius to the contributions of other men. That doesn't mean he plagiarized, but it means that he was a part of a whole culture, and other people had contributed a great deal, which he absorbed into himself, and then added to that his own discovery. And that little 3% was enough to make him stand out above the herd to the extent that we say People say he had the greatest mind that man ever, that ever was in a human body. I don't say that. I don't know. But I know that it has been said. Leonardo would be another example. These people, he couldn't have painted if he had lived now. He couldn't have painted what he did. He might have been able to paint, but he needed that impulse to go. In other words, there was a ray, there was a wave of magnetism, there was a wave of consciousness going, that these people going with were able to do much more. It's sort of like going along with the stream of a river. If you swim with the stream, you can swim so much faster. And if you try to swim against the stream, you may still be swept in the wrong direction. So then, with the consciousness that comes with this teaching of yoga, we have found, emphasized in all the books, practically all the books, that all you need to do is this posture. All you need to do is learn this philosophy, and you've got it. But there's always been some sort of missing ingredient, an ingredient that they automatically understand in India. They don't talk about it because, well, they talk about it some, but they don't talk much because it's just accepted. And that is that if one follows a particular way, not just getting it from books, not just reading, but getting in tune with a particular vibration. There are different vibrations, and no one is to say that one is the only one. We have to feel, we have to compare different paths and see which is compatible to us, recognizing that it's a matter of our own nature, not which is the best way, because there is no one best way, but according to our nature, which we feel most compatible with. And if we will then understand that what we are doing is getting in tune with that wave, with that ray of consciousness, then we'll be gaining a power that will help us to succeed. So here again we find a union of the East and the West that is very important. The Eastern sort of intuitive influence, which is the real way that they try to teach. I mean, many saints in India have not talked at all. They've maintained silence. Well, how did they teach anybody? It's understood that you come under that saint's influence and you're going to change. Some saints will, maybe after years, teach the disciple what he ought to do. But by then the disciple's ready. There was one, Lahiri Mahasaya, had a disciple who for years served him. And many people, thousands of people, came to get initiation during that time. And this disciple never received initiation. He never felt badly. He was absolutely sure the guru knew what was best for him. But after 8 years, the guru took him aside and said, "Now I'll initiate you." And he got initiation, and that same day he had the experience of God. So he was preparing him all that time. He was giving him something. But it just wasn't this particular one's way to go through the techniques yet. He had other things to develop. Well, in these ways we see that the East and the West need to be brought together. The logical approach, the external orientation, on the testing field of the world, and the internal intuitive unfoldment that comes from the practice of yoga. These two need to be brought into a harmonious whole. And in fact, each needs the other. It isn't as if one were really short in this. The skills that we've developed here are very important skills. I mean, yes, if you've developed to a certain level, you don't need the rational approach of the West. But I've found that great masters in India, even though they work intuitively, have a much clearer grasp of logic too. They're able to use it very well. They are able to work on all levels much more clearly. But nevertheless, do we go with a society that only talks to the very top and lets everything else just sort of be confused? The kind of logic that you find in India, again, can be illustrated by a time I went into the Calcutta newspaper. I forget the name of it at the moment. The Statesman, that's what it is. And I went in to take an ad for our ashram for some function or other. I forget. I think it was that. Anyway, I came out and walked through the backyard, the courtyard, to leave by the back gate. And there was a guard there. And he said, "I'm sorry, you're not allowed to use this gate." I said, "Well, I would not have used it had I known coming in. But now that I'm leaving, there's really no point in holding me. What you mean is not that I can't go through the gate, but I'm not allowed in the yard. And I've already crossed the yard. I'll have to cross it twice if I go back." "No, you're not allowed to use this gate." But he was meant to keep people from coming in. But to go out was nothing. There was no guard at the front that they had that I had to be cleared through or anything. He never did see it. It was the sort of thing that drove me up the wall and has driven every Westerner that I know in India up the wall. You find yourself confronted with such total illogic. If you get down from the peak into the valleys, you are confronted with people who have neither intuition nor logic, and you realize that we've got to help them on this level. And it's a good kind of helping, because it will bring people here up too. If you're on this level, and we all are, at least in our daily activities, and if we have to have daily activities, then logic becomes very important. To be able to see clearly that this isn't the issue and that isn't the issue, there's the issue. To be able to weed out all the extraneous and find the one point of truth. Without that, you can't accomplish anything in this world, and even spiritually, you won't have the discrimination to grow until you transcend logic and are functioning on that level of pure intuition. So the two are really needed. We also need their intuitive approach, because if we keep thinking that everything can be settled by logic, then we reach the point where all our aspirations are pedestrian. We never really aspire to that level of communion which just defies. I'm against using drugs, and it's a very strict rule here in our community that people are not allowed to use them. But I have to say that from what I've observed, and I've observed many negative results from taking drugs, there has been one positive result, and it's been a very positive one. It's helped people suddenly to break through this hypnosis of logic, to make them see suddenly that other levels of consciousness are possible besides those which we can just reason our way to. And that's been the start of a great spiritual awakening in this country, where people have suddenly realized that maybe all this talk of samadhi and so on has potential for being right. Whereas when we see everything as just ABC, we can't break through this veil of Maya and enter into a state of consciousness that really has no dimensions. You know, a very interesting thing Ramakrishna used to say, whenever you see a body of water, this is mentioned in Autobiography of a Yogi, Master Mahashaya was saying it, particularly when you see the horizon line, the body of water itself is a reminder of spiritual things, the restlessness of the mind, and how when the body of water becomes calm, then it reflects the sky up above, the moon. And so when the mind is calm, it reflects spirit. That is one image, but there's another one that he used, and that is the horizon line. When you concentrate on the horizon line and try to penetrate that horizon line, what you're doing, first of all, is getting rid of two of the three dimensions. You don't have depth or height, you only have width. And then you're trying to penetrate through that one dimension of the horizon line, means you're trying to go beyond the three-dimensional world that we know. That's why yogis say to meditate also on the horizon line of the eyebrows, to try to go through this one dimension into a realm which has no dimensions, at least as we know them, where you could be in the most distant star as much as you are right here. Because, well, I mentioned to a great saint in India, Ananda Moyi Ma, I said, "Wouldn't you come with me to America? So many people would love to see you here and would be so inspired." And her answer was, I don't need to go, I'm there already. This is the consciousness of an enlightened being who has broken out of the barrier of the ego and suddenly discovers that he is that consciousness that pervades everything. There's no dimension in that. There's no large or small. The universe is, you're just there, that's all. Well, again, if we can break through this hypnosis of matter, of time and space, of three dimensions, and the practice of yoga and the philosophy of India helps us in that way, then we'll be able to bring a state of consciousness, first of all, that all of us really want, because we were made for that. We were made to transcend humanity and discover something higher. We were made for an absolute joy. We were made for absolute wisdom and absolute love. And we're never content. We never can be content until we find that. But secondly, in our daily activities, if we can water them from the springs that flow from the heights, then those clear waters will have a much different influence than the muddy waters of, let's say, a merely educationally trained mind. All great inspiration has come from above. All great insights have come from above. I was on Lake Rollins yesterday, and it's a very long lake. I rented a boat. Asha came with me, and we went to the tip, and there we went swimming. And wow, was it cold. I said to somebody was saying, "Howdy, how can you go in there?" And I said, "I don't know. I want to get out." But anyway, I said, "How is it? How come it's so cold?" Well, apparently, that's up pretty high and pretty close to where the snow is melting. But at the other end of the lake, the water was very warm because it's such a long lake. Well, when we are too enmeshed in the world, we're at the other end of the lake and the water is warmed by the heat of worldly desires and involvements and so on. But when we're back at the source, our inspirations are pure. They come from the melting snows of spirit, from the sort of condensations of superconsciousness. And the more that people live in that way, in tune with this higher, the more everything they do seems to fall into place and to be right. It's sort of like a little doll made of sticks and strings. If you don't pick it up by that top knot at the top of the head, it's all just a jumble. But once you pick it up at the right point, everything falls into place. So it is that if we can introduce into our Western life the recognition of the importance of spending some time in tune with this higher aspect of our being, I believe that we've reached the point of such imbalance in our lives that if we don't do that, we're just going to destroy ourselves. I believe that we've come to a point where what we're doing is crucial on all levels. And one thing I'm trying to do with my short life is try to show or to suggest ways in which this inspiration could flow outward and influence different aspects of our lives in practical ways, because I think that's important too. If you're thinking, well, I need to be out among people because that will help me to test what I'm developing inwardly, let's say, in my meditation. So you get out among ordinary, worldly-minded people, people who are only living on a level of desire, and you try to act in a spiritual way. They don't understand you for anything. If you're being calm, they think that's because you're indifferent. If you're being loving, they think you're coming on to them. If you're joyful, they think you're just kidding yourself or being hysterical even, or who knows what. It's incredible the degrees of misunderstanding that people can come up with, and that's the feedback you're going to get. And it's going to be awfully hard for you to hold your own and to really learn lessons considering the responses of those people. If you can be more with people who are on the path, if you can be more with people who are trying and who really do understand. I was reading in the Reader's Digest a few years ago of the story of a man who was killed in a hit-and-run accident. And his son decided he was going to find the killer. And there was some sort of a paint that was either on the man's clothes or somehow, anyway, he was able to trace it after 20 years to somebody's vehicle. After 20 years of seeking, he was able to find his father's killer. And he was brought to justice and he went to prison. And the Reader's Digest article ended saying that he slept peacefully that night, and so did a lot of other decent people in whatever town he was living in. I thought, my God, what kind of values is this, that revenge has to be the definition of decency? Our values are so absolutely scrambled. And as long as we're living in that kind of world, it almost is a world to get out of. Because it'll feed back to you so much confusion that you hardly know whether you're really going in the right direction or not. People will get you to thinking that you're really doing the wrong thing by trying to be spiritual. You should show feeling. And what they mean by feeling is emotion. Well, emotion is really the devil in you. Emotionalism is what pulls you down. What we want to do is have feeling, yes. Love, joy, but emotion, no. Feeling is deeper than emotion. Emotion is just ruffled feeling. But you won't get that from the people in the world. Turn on your TV set. First 5 minutes, you're going to see somebody shouting at somebody, hitting somebody, insulting somebody, perhaps killing somebody. It's just a sort of a seething mass of emotions, and that's the kind of feedback that people get all the time. Well, I think it's important that we use these teachings to also change the world outside. Otherwise, we are only changing a part of the picture. If the goal of yoga is to take people out of the world and into ashrams, or urge them to, in addition to whatever you're doing that's normal, spend some time doing your postures and meditate a little bit and so on in your home, then we're not giving them a full enough picture to help them to achieve even the spiritual transformation that they want. So I believe that it's important that we use these teachings of yoga to change our lives outwardly, as well as using our outward lives to refine our understanding of yoga. That if we can take this inspiration and show how this inspiration can affect the way we do business, and that this is not to be impractical, that people who do business in this way are more likely to succeed than those who are out cutting other people's throats. That if we use this to influence the way we conduct our families, raise children, paint, write music, sing, whatever it might be, our Western way has been to only concentrate on technique. In the arts, if they come up, I read in Newsweek a few years ago some great new thing in art. What was this new thing? Was it a new understanding, a new insight into life, some new ray of wisdom they were trying to bring in the world? No, it was a method of putting little bits of glass and glue together to make some sort of new objects. It's all technique. If you go to singing teachers, they'll only teach you technique. Technique for how to use your voice as a sounding board. It would be very interesting to learn singing from a yogic standpoint. That is to say, to sing from the chakras. If you sing from the heart center, for example, you put love into your voice. If you sing only from the chest, it's a big full tone that can fill a hall. But it's only physical. It doesn't change your consciousness. So the two together need each other. They need to influence each other. We need to have the inner consciousness that comes from meditating, and to bring that consciousness. I have many, many practical things that I have to resolve in the community. We are living in a world that we have to be in competition with in many ways, earning money, having businesses, raising children, and so on. But I've found that I don't give answers unless I first go within and try to feel an answer. Sometimes I don't feel an answer, and I just have to say, well, my reason tells me that this is the way to do it. But as much as possible, I found that by going within, I found that I need to go within, and when I do get that kind of guidance, it seems to work. There's always a flow in it when you go from the inner guidance. And it always is sort of chopped up, as reason itself is, tends to analyze, to see how things are different from each other instead of how they relate to each other. And when we go at it in that way, then in this intuitive way, then we find that everything begins to flow. Everything sort of is a part of a whole. And there's even a most intriguing kind of law that comes into play. It's some sort of higher law, that a law of simultaneity, that you put out the energy to do things right, and other things happen that are right also. They just sort of appear on the scene at what appears to be the coincidentally right moment. But these things flow when you're in a flow. It's as if the world itself began to reflect back to you the kind of energy you're putting out to it. That the world can be your friend if you're the world's friend. How different that is from the Western approach of practically plundering our planet to grab its riches. But when we work with our planet instead of against it, then we find that our planet can be our friend and can give us abundantly. So the Indian approach, the yogic approach, can very much influence the West on practical levels, not just a matter of giving people peace of mind, not just a matter of getting them to be more in tune with the higher self, but in very practical ways influencing their business, their work, their families, every aspect of life. And I believe that this is the role of yoga in the West, that it's not only to take people out of normal life, but to transform normal life on every level. Our job as yoga teachers is not only to give techniques of yoga and a lovely philosophy, it's also to bring people a state of consciousness that will affect their lives and the lives of everybody they touch in every practical level imaginable. I believe that it's a very important role. I sort of see the West as, and I'm assuming you all accept basic aspects of the Indian philosophy like reincarnation, but if you don't, then take this as a pleasant way of expressing it. I see the trend here in America as being the different parts of our society seem to be composed of ex-Romans seeking only pleasure, ex-Atlanteans just wild and gung-ho on electronics and gadgetry, American Indians who are all into ecology, and I think the American Indians are sort of getting their own back by coming back as white men, and then the Indian Indians. And I think the American Indians and the Indian Indians often are the same. For example, here at Ananda, we all of us feel in tune with the American Indians and with the Indian Indians both. But in both cases, the American Indian emphasized particularly the need to be in tune with Mother Earth. And the Indian Indian emphasized particularly the need to be in tune with the Cosmic Mother. But this idea of being in tune with something larger than oneself is the trend which makes them both compatible with each other. And so we can lump them together in this most important sense of all. I see these three basic trends. And the Indian trend, the Indian previous incarnation people, they're sort of an undercurrent still. But I believe that they have power where the others don't have power. The Roman trend has no power. It has money, it has wealth. They're the ones who are writing most of the articles in the paper, in the press, the establishment. They're the ones who have worldly power right now. But it's a power that doesn't seem to have any backbone to it because it has no beliefs. I was reading an article by somebody, one of our members sent this essayist, Brian something or other. He's a well-known essayist, but he's not well-known to me. And he sent him my article on meaning in the arts, and this man wrote back and very much liked it. And then he sent me some articles he's written that say basically the same thing. One of them analyzed the most famous writers in America in the last decade, and just tore them to shreds, because basically all they talk about is technique, not meaning. There's no substance to what they're saying. They think that they're doing a big thing because they've got some new technique that they're evolving of self-expression. Techniques aren't going to do it. He even had the courage to say publicly something that I've always felt, and that is a lot of people don't feel, and that is that Picasso is really sort of a balloon. But it's some new way of doing it, but I think he sold himself out doing the clever thing. He was a very clever man. There's this story about Picasso that somebody showed him a Picasso painting, and Picasso said, "That's a fake. Fake Picasso." And the man said, "But it has your signature on it." And Picasso said, "Well, I can paint a fake Picasso as well as anyone else." But however you feel about Picasso, this writer was making a case that I think we can all agree on, and that is that the general trend in literature and in the establishment in general has been away from meaning and values and all towards sort of a very superficial view of everything. There's no goal in life. Everything is accidental. And this is sort of the in way to think. And then, of course, the scientists and the ex-Atlanteans, they don't have any faith either. They're just trying to find how to do things better. But sooner or later, that kind of thing falls flat. Whenever you get in a society a trend where some people really know what they're doing and believe in it, they may come up from the peasant class, and yet they sooner or later are the ones who rule. I'm not talking of ruling in a powerful way now. That's a political figure metaphor. But the influence that we're talking about, that is important. That we, because we have faith, look how few people it took to bring Christianity to the whole Western world. A handful, and most of them they tried to kill off. Look at the few Buddhists who changed the entire East. All of the East is influenced by Buddhism. Just a few people who really have something and are really sincere in what they're trying to do change the whole course of history. That's the basis for my absolute conviction that the role of yoga in the West has only just begun. And that in the next century or two centuries, we're going to see that the entire West has become changed by the very fact of this teaching having been brought to this country particularly, and the West in general. And yes, we'll take it back to India and remind them of what they have and so on, but we're concerned with the role of yoga in the West, and I'm absolutely convinced that the time is going to come, and it will come in the lifetime of some of you, where this teaching is going to be the influence that saves the West. Why yoga specifically? It could be Zen, it could be other things. I'm not limiting yoga to yoga. I'm talking of this need for an inner life, which yoga exemplifies but can't monopolize. The need for an inner life which feeds our outer life and gives it meaning, gives it new dimensions. The scripture of yoga is Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. Nobody knows how long ago Patanjali lived, but it was many centuries ago. The Yoga Sutras begin with the simple sentence, "Now we come to the practice of yoga, to the study of yoga." And that word "now," according to Swami Sri Yukteswar, is a very operative and important word. What he's doing is showing the link between yoga and other systems of philosophy. There is not, as many people think, not only in the West, but also in the East, many scholars think that each of these systems of philosophy is self-contained, complete, and in a sense, in competition with the others. But in fact, what we had in the ancient system was a very holistic approach to life. And the different paths, like bhakti yoga, jnana yoga, and so on, were all different emphases given to a central teaching. And the different philosophies are also different emphases given to a central teaching, a central truth. Now we come to yoga presupposes a previous study. And the three of the six basic systems of Indian philosophy, the three that are particularly geared toward spiritual unfoldment as opposed to working in this world, are Shankhya, Yoga, Vedanta. Shankhya philosophy has for its primary purpose the emphasis on the importance of seeking a higher reality. It shows the illusory nature of this world and how if we cling to this world we're going to be disappointed again and again. Therefore, the need to find a more bedrock reality in the spirit. The Shankhya philosophy, however, can't speak of the spirit because its emphasis is on our need to transcend this state of existence. Then, the next philosophy is, if you transcend this existence, then what do you achieve? What alternative is there? And this is known as the Vedanta philosophy. This is the aspect of Indian philosophy which describes the nature of the universe, how the universe was created, and more particularly the states of consciousness that the yogi or the aspirant attains when he goes into samadhi, when he breaks free of ego consciousness and unties the knots of karma. So Vedanta philosophy describes the goal. Shankhya philosophy describes gives the incentive, describes the need for seeking that goal. And yoga philosophy describes the path. Each one of these is important to the whole picture. If you don't know where you're going, you could very well use the teachings of yoga for purely worldly gain. If you don't know why you should seek in the first place, you might very well remain content with a life of just sense satisfaction. And so, when we take up the study of yoga, it specifically follows upon the study of Shankhya. Shankhya tells you your need. Yoga tells you how to get out of that need. Vedanta describes the goal. Yoga could equally easily and effectively be studied after studying Vedanta, because once you know the goal, as well as the need for getting out of where you are, then you have even more incentive for growing spiritually. But yoga, as a system, is not concerned with beliefs. And that's why people like Maharishi Mahesh Yogi are able to say that yoga is not a religion. It is a religion, however, if we think of it in terms of having a spiritual goal, because that is the real goal of yoga. It's not a religion, however, and he's perfectly right in saying it in this sense, that it's not based on a system of beliefs, but of practices. So yoga is a system of techniques, of practices. Secondly, it's a path. You don't just practice those things for no purpose. There's a direction that you're going, and yoga can be described in both these ways, as a path, as a series of steps in a direction, and as the techniques that help you to walk that path. And I'm going to talk about this, but not today, the path that Patanjali describes, the Eightfold Path. He's not really describing techniques. In fact, in his whole system, he doesn't really give techniques. Little bits here and there he talks about, if you want to develop the power of levitation, for example, meditate on cotton wool or air or things like that. He gives a few little things. He hints at more. But more what he's describing is the path itself, the stages that people follow. And in this, it's true for everybody on the spiritual path, whether he be a yogi or not. We all go in certain directions. It's not as if yogis are going to have certain inner experiences because they're yogis. It will rather be that the practice of yoga helps to prepare them for experiences that are universal. I know that I've described things like the spiritual eye to people who hadn't heard of yoga before, And not many, certainly, but some people have said, oh, is that what I've been seeing? And they'd seen this thing because their minds were concentrated enough, and therefore it appeared to them. It's a universal experience. The things that yoga describes are universal. It's true that according to cultural bias, according to the particular personality that you have, the predilections that you've built up over a lifetime, you will see the inner experience, the universal aspect of it, crystallized in forms that are more particularly your own. For example, a Christian is more likely to see Jesus than Krishna, and a Hindu is more likely to see Krishna than Jesus, though not, he's more likely to see Jesus than a Christian is to see Krishna, for the reason that he's heard the name Jesus so long. And the interesting thing is that Jesus has appeared to quite a few Indian yogis. He's never told any of them to become a Christian. At least never that I've heard. The path that he describes is a universal path, and I want to go into that in depth, but this isn't the time for it. The practice of yoga, then, must be understood in a universal way that everybody can practice it effectively, because it relates to man, not to Hindu man or Indian-oriented man. It's not a cultural thing. There are certain things that are universal about man. We all have eyes and nose and mouth. We all have a spine. We all have a nervous system. We all have brains. Almost all of us. I don't mean that entirely frivolously, but it's certainly interesting and amusing that on TV in Germany and in England recently, people were shown who have been found medically not to have brains. And you'd think they'd be vegetables, but two of them are in the university studying and the other is perfectly intelligent. But what happened was that they didn't have sufficient coordination over their bodies. They'd sort of tend to list to one side as they walked or something that made them, drew them to the attention of the medical profession, who tried to examine to see what might be wrong with their nervous systems. And in these medical exams, it was found they didn't have brains. So it makes us, at least who are on the yogic path, realize that after all, this is only a computer, this brain, but there has to be an operator for the computer. And so there's something behind the brain that works. There's some kind of intelligence that, when we leave the body, seems to be, according to people who have had the experience, able to function with perfect clarity. Intriguing. Anyway, we basically are made the same way. And it's that aspect of our being that yoga deals with. Yoga deals with this nervous system, with this brain, with the energy in the body, with certain realities that many of us are even quite familiar with. Yoga tries to take us where we are and develop us from there to higher and higher fulfillments, realizations of our potential. But there are certain things that we all know, and yoga doesn't try to fly in the face of common knowledge, but rather to explore its natural goals. One is the recognition, which is perfectly universal, that when we feel good, there's sort of a rising of consciousness. When we feel bad, there's sort of a lowering of consciousness. We have many words that reflect this. We say, I feel uplifted, I feel high, I feel like soaring, or I feel in the dumps, I feel down, I feel depressed. These things are in all languages because it reflects a universal awareness. In all scriptures, too, we hear that heaven is above and hell is below. And now that we have telescopes and realize that the world is round and so on, we know that this cannot be a cosmic phenomenon. There's no up for heaven to be in. There's no down, really, except in the center of the earth, but what's down for us is up for the people in Australia. There's no absolute directions. But we find that, again, in a human sense, this is true, that we're in a state of heaven when the energy in our body rises, in a state of hell when the energy in our body is drawn downward. And the yoga teachings, which confine it, concentrate it on the chakras in the spine, the need to direct that flow of energy upward, the awakening of the kundalini, this is totally in consonance with the understanding not only of medical science, but of all human experience. All we need to do in teaching it is to draw people's attention to something they know already. Another thing that they know already is that when they feel love, they feel it here in the heart. Not the physical heart, it's actually behind the physical heart in the spine. And when yogis say to concentrate in the heart, what they're doing is trying to develop a feeling that's there already to some extent. Yoga tries to work with nature rather than against nature. And that's what makes it such a wonderful science. It's not a man-invented, man-made science. It's something rooted in observations of nature, as all true science should be, has to be. Another thing that we've found, all of us, is that when we concentrate deeply, we tend to knit the eyebrows. And yogis point out that the seat of concentration is at the point between the eyebrows. And that if we will concentrate deeply here, we'll be able to develop our concentration. In many ways, yoga just observes what everybody sees. It's sort of like Sherlock Holmes and Watson. Sherlock Holmes tells Watson, "You see, you do not observe." And this is how most people are. They see, they do not observe. We've got to be able to examine these things, and that's what yogis have done. They've examined the phenomena of life and discovered that there are certain of these phenomena, which we're all familiar with, that lead us in a direction toward enlightenment, and others that don't. That when the heart's feeling is aroused, but not turned upward, it goes outward toward emotion, toward attachment, toward even the corollaries of those, depression, moods, and so on. And so it's important not only to awaken this feeling, but direct it in the right way. One thing about yoga that makes it such a great science is not only the fact of its being rooted in a very close observation of nature and observation from above, so that you can see not only what the phenomena are, but what they mean relative to man's desire to grow spiritually. But also we have the fact that in India, because they have had this tradition for thousands of years of yoga teaching, techniques, and so on, it has been possible to create a tradition. Every teacher can only say so much, and if he's saying it to a hostile audience, he'll have to say less. And when he dies, others will dilute it so quickly that it will soon pass away. Saint Teresa of Avila, whom I've quoted several times already, bewailed the fact that most priests who serve as spiritual counselors, spiritual guides, know nothing about these higher teachings and do incalculable harm, is what she said. Incalculable harm in giving people the wrong advice because they haven't had experience and they don't have a tradition to correct their lack of experience. For example, Saint Teresa reached the point in her meditation where she couldn't think anymore. Her mind was held firm and she couldn't use the prayers and meditations that were prescribed by her spiritual guides. And their counsel to her was to bring her mind down. She had to do those things. They didn't understand that there is a higher state where the mind doesn't think any longer. And it took her many years of lots of suffering before she realized that this was simply God's way and they didn't understand it. That's when she made that statement about the incalculable harm that these people create in the counseling that they give people. So, it's again because of a lack of tradition. And she wrote this statement, and everybody saw what a great saint she was, so they accepted it, but because it didn't mean anything to them from their experience, it quickly died out. And those teachings that she had discovered in the form of the deeper aspects of the path, the ways of attaining that state, which were a little bit of yoga. I mean, she said, for example, that when the state of ecstasy comes, the soul shoots upward like a bullet shot out of a gun. Isn't that a description of the energy flying up through the spine, the kundalini? It certainly is. She spoke of the soul as being centered in the top of the head. Isn't that a description of the Sahasrara? It certainly is. There were a lot of things that these saints have said that were very deep, but because people didn't know what they were talking about, because it hadn't been put into a system, therefore it quickly sort of slipped into the background and was left on the shelves of the libraries of mystical tradition while people talked about other things. I mentioned to a Catholic priest once some of these teachings of Saint Teresa, and he said, "Oh yes, well I know they're true, all right, but we can't teach that sort of thing to people. They don't have the tradition to, that's why they can't." So they never talk about that, and it ceases effectively to exist as far as the average orthodoxy, even the priests, are concerned. There are very few priests who know anything. When I lived, about this sort of thing, I mean, when I lived in New Camaldoli, and the Camaldoli's order is considered the cream of Catholic contemplative monasticism. It's produced something like 300 saints and many popes, and it's a very, very highly respected order in this particular aspect of it, the cream, as I say. And those monks were coming to me to learn how to meditate. They didn't know anything. One of them took Kriya Yoga initiation from me, and they were all very interested in learning about meditation. And one of them advised me, they had hoped I would join their order, one of them advised me that it would be much better not to join their order. He said, "You'll be able to do much more of your meditative practices if you live on your own than here, because we have to spend 7 hours a day just la 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 la, you know, just all outward singing, which is beautiful, inspiring, and yet it's not inward. And they have very little time for inward contemplation." So, again, we don't have the tradition here, and what one saint discovers is very quickly lost again. In India, because they've had that tradition, two things have happened. One is they've been talking to a receptive audience, because the audience had been primed to understand what they were talking about, so they could say a great deal more. Where here, a friend of mine went to Padre Pio, who was a great mystic in Italy in this century. He died, I think, in the mid-60s. And he performed many miracles, including bilocation and so on. He was a great soul, a great saint. Anyway, this friend went to make his confession with Padre Pio. And he told him he practiced yoga. And Padre Pio said, "Oh, you shouldn't talk about these things, but you're doing the right thing." They can't talk because they know that they'd lose whatever effectiveness they might have, because they would be very quickly excommunicated if they said too much. So they just have to keep quiet. Meister Eckhart, who said some very wonderful things, fortunately died just before the notice of excommunication reached him. And so he was not quite officially excommunicated, and therefore he's held in high regard. But he was, in fact, a great mystic. The tradition wasn't there, and so they weren't able to teach. In India it was there, and so they were able to teach. They were able to say a great deal more. Even there they couldn't say a lot, but they could keep it going by the fact that there was this continuous tradition, a guru with disciples. And to those disciples, he was able to teach. And then they were able to add to what he taught. And so gradually over the centuries, great, great insights. The lore in India is absolutely fantastic. And of those old scriptures, I believe that only one-tenth of the Vedas are still extant. There's a tremendous lore that's either lost or buried somewhere that still can be found. The wisdom in this field makes us look like babies. They have a tremendous knowledge in this regard. So there's the tradition, the fact that they can teach, the fact that they can make it clear, the fact that they develop a language that says specific things. In many ways, we find a teaching that has enabled them to create and preserve a science that is so vital to our spiritual well-being here. And to say, well, we have it all here, is really not to know the facts. We don't. We have the tradition, we don't have the knowledge. They have the tradition and the knowledge. And it would be very wise for us to be like disciples before that great lore that they have. Not to feel, well, we know better than they because we can put men on the moon. We can put men on the moon. Can we put them into samadhi? Can we get them to the most distant stars? That's what they can do. The greatness of that science is really par excellence. And I feel that if yoga has a role in the West, it's up to us, and we will be blessed in the process to help bring this science in its pure essence to other people. Thank you all for coming here.